ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
I mean, why didn't they just use Harry Holt's high school nickname, Puss? These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
Search The Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The price of crude oil has spiked again as US President Donald Trump threatens to place a 20% toll on exports from the contested Strait of Hormuz. So what economic costs remain behind a ceasefire that appears to have effectively collapsed? And what's at stake in a strait that moves a huge proportion of the liquid fuels that the world needs? Plus, what has our addiction to the property market done to productivity? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Daniel Ziffer.
And I'm Ian Verinder, the ABC's Chief Business Correspondent.
Ian, great to have you on the pod. We're talking about fuel and property. This is going to be a fascinating 2 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Could go all day.
Now, the latest on the Strait of Hormuz. The US says it is reinstating a blockade of Iranian ships and ports in the Persian Gulf. The US president has used the noted diplomacy measure of his own social media channel to suggest that the US will charge a toll when ships try and transit. And there's been a third night of strikes on Iran. A resolution looks very far away. Let's get into the economics. What's been the response?
Well, oil prices have shot up, as you'd expect, but nowhere near to the level that they were, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the conflict coming on board. And you must recall back then, a lot of analysts were saying, oh, it could go to $120 a barrel, which it did, but next step was 150, then 200, and sky's the limit. So we're sitting at just above 80 at the moment. And really, in historical terms, that's not overly high. And when you take into consideration that we've had, this has been going on for several months now, we've had a lot of oil reserves pumped into the global system to try and keep prices stable. But that's not going to last forever. Something's got to give soon.
So that's why I wonder, why isn't that rise more? Now, 10%, huge jump in a day, but when you pull the graph out and go longer, we're talking about a barrel of crude oil being US$83. Now, just a few months ago, it was above 110. During the Ukraine conflict, it was more than 120. What does it tell you that it's not more? There hasn't been a bigger reaction to what's clearly a collapse of this ceasefire or what looked like a way out of this problem.
I think everybody, right from the word go, thought this was only going to last a few days. Mm. And then they've banked on the idea every time Donald Trump comes out and says, oh, look, you know, the Iranians are desperate for a deal. We're going to do it. We're going to obliterate them. They're always looking for the immediate resolution for this thing. But it just doesn't ever seem to be resolved. And it's astounding that everyone is still really hanging off these words, these promises that just don't ever seem to come to any kind of fruition.
We will see the price as it changes. Obviously, this conflict now has just injected so much uncertainty. I do wonder if advanced economies like Australia and others that can weather the price rises, right? It goes into input costs, it makes things more expensive, but they're not as dependent on it, for example, for heating and things like that. Are they just learning to deal with it? Are they just going to get used to what they have to, which is you import a lot of it, you've just got to pay the price that's available?
I don't think anyone's really going to get used to it. And I don't think the full price impact has been felt just yet. So we've had a lot of supply knocked out of the market, obviously. Now, Saudi Arabia has managed to get quite a bit of supply over to the Red Sea in that pipeline. And so we've seen workarounds to a certain extent with oil. When it comes to gas, that is not the case. LNG prices in both Europe and Asia have really rocketed up in the last few weeks. And there's, you know, talk of cargo is being diverted from one place to the other. Usually the Asian buyers are outstripping the European buyers. So this is while ships are actually, you know, they've left port and they're on their way to Europe and they're rerouting back to Asia. So there's a lot of competition in both those markets to secure supplies. And really, I think, you know, the fact that some oil has been, you know, diverted out of Saudi Arabia, the fact that we've seen a huge amount of reserves come down, you know, being distributed through the global economy, that's kept prices down for the moment. But reserves tend to run out at some point, and we're getting very close to that point. And bear in mind, too, there's another big, big factor in the supply-demand equation here on the supply side, and that is Russia. Now, Russia is one of the world's biggest exporters of crude oil and refined fuel. It's being hit and hit hard by Ukraine at its refineries and its ports. And so it is now in the position where you've got fuel shortages, refined fuel shortages through Russia. So they've now had to start importing refined fuel, which is something that is just beyond comprehension for most Russians. And you're even seeing fistfights at petrol stations after people have been lining up for hours on end. So that is a major factor that is is yet to really hit global oil prices, I think.
So let's get to LNG in a second, but let's let that sink in. Russia is importing refined fuel. We had this big expansion of reserves. We tapped huge reserves. Is your contention essentially that we're getting to a real crunch point where all the things that we did to unlock supply, to try and find workarounds when this conflict started and essentially removed 1 in 5 barrels of oil from the world supply, that we're coming to the end of the ability of the things that we've done to meet that demand?
Most of the analysts I've spoken to point to September as a real crunch time when things really hit the wall in terms of the shortages from the Gulf, even despite Saudi Arabia's best efforts to try and get as much out as they can, that the shortages will really hit the wall in September. And that was before Russia started to import fuel into its economy. So, you know, you're not only knocking out a major supplier in terms of Russia from the global economy, you're turning them into an importer.
And
so that is really going to affect the dynamics here. And I think everyone seems to be living in a false sense of security, particularly in Australia. I mean, you know, petrol prices at the bowser are quite reasonable. I mean, they're only slightly above now where they were when the conflict started.
People hate me reminding about this, but Australia has some of the cheapest and most lightly taxed fuel in the world. When you get the graph out and you're driving a lot, this is actually one of the places you would want to be. We talked a lot about petrol. Let's get on to LNG. You talked there about ships being diverted, about massive demand. We haven't felt the squeeze as badly here, probably in part due to that gas reservation policy that's existed for a long time in Western Australia and now in the East Coast as well. What's that LNG situation where Asia and Europe are competing for this vital gas?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, Europe was getting a lot of its gas from Russia. They are, as I understand, still they're getting gas back from Russia at the moment. So there's a little bit of demand being filled there. But, you know, the problem with the Gulf is that LNG is really difficult to transport. The only transport for LNG out of the Gulf is via shipping lanes. And LNG transporters are essentially like a floating neutron bomb because it is highly, highly flammable and volatile material. You've got it sitting in those massive big like kettles on the top of a ship. If one of those goes up, it is just going to wreak havoc right across the Gulf region. So you've seen all of those tankers just basically sticking to port. They're not moving at all. Now, one smaller tanker last week was hit by Iranian drones, and that caused really the blow up that we've seen now between both Iran and the US. So you're not going to see any LNG coming out of the Gulf, and of course it supplies around about 20% of the globe's demand. So that's going to be it already has kicked in to be a major problem. It's been a big bargaining chip for Australia though, because you know, Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister, managed to scoot around you know, most of the big refining ports around Asia, and essentially said to them, look, we need to secure our liquid fuels, diesel and petrol, because we don't really have much in the way of refining facilities here, and you need our gas, and we've got a lot of gas, so if you want to keep getting our gas, you better make sure we keep getting the fuel. So it's actually worked in our favour, the gas. In terms of domestic gas prices, Do you remember what happened after Russia invaded Ukraine 5 years ago? I mean,
absolutely.
You know, and that's price spike in gas. And people don't really equate this, but the price spike in gas led through to a huge increase in the price of electricity here, because we generate a lot of electricity with gas, and it's also the final factor in the electricity market. So when everything else runs out, you turn on the gas. And so it's the price setter. And so because gas prices went ballistic, so too did electricity prices. That drove up our inflation rate. And so the Reserve Bank then whacked on 13 rate hikes as a result of all of that.
It is hard for people to probably get their heads around, but yes, gas actually sets the price of electricity, because it is the vital bit you can turn on and off very quickly to smooth out our grid as the sun goes down, essentially.
Yeah, it's called, it's the last factor in the thing. So when everything else has run out, when there's no renewables, you don't have enough coal-fired generation to fill the gap, you turn on the gas. And so because it is that final factor, it is the price setter. One thing we haven't really discussed, though, is the tolls that are going through the Strait of Hormuz. I mean,
was it the idea that the ceasefire was to stop the Iranian regime putting tolls on the Strait of Hormuz? Now the US wants to have its own floating dinghy toll booth as well.
Yeah, not only that, it's a 20% tax. So a 20% fee. So on an ordinary or the average size vessel going through the straits, that would cost around about $32 million. And Iran, you might recall, was hoping to impose a $2 million toll. So the US is talking
Bargain.
About a 16 times price hike there. And look, you know, consistency has never been one of Donald Trump's strong points, obviously, because he's argued against tolls. You can't have them at all because, you know, you'd be imposing them all around the world. But he also at one stage had an idea where both the US and Iran could share the toll. So he's now decided to basically just outbid them when it comes to tolls, and in the same breath, legitimise Iran's claim for a toll.
Ian, I guess another issue is there are pinch points for shipping around the world. We saw this when a massive ship got stuck in the Suez Canal a few years ago. If this toll occurred, would there be a signal for other parts of the world to go, hold on, we've got a narrow shipping lane and a massive defence force as well?
You do pay to go through the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal, but they were built. And so that's a bit like, you know, driving on a toll road. You know, the obvious example close to home is Singapore, the Malacca Straits there. So, you know, what happens there? Does Indonesia and Singapore divvy up the spoils, or, you know, do we charge, you know, to maybe get ships to go between PNG and the tip of Queensland?
I think that's more profitable than the route between us and Antarctica. But now, look, to move on, we were chatting with Gareth Hutchins on the pod yesterday about the fascinating new research from the Centre for Policy Development, CPD. Now, it suggests a gap between productivity growth and the typical workers' pay. Now, Ian, you've tackled the productivity conversation from another angle in your piece this morning that people can read on the ABC website. What is one of the factors behind sluggish Australian productivity that we might not have thought of?
Well, look, productivity is one of these ethereal concepts that it's really easy to measure if all you do is produce widgets or even, you know, with agriculture, it's actually quite easy to measure. You figure out how much material you're using to get a certain yield at the end, whether it's wheat or whether it's nuts and bolts, you know, how many people, how much labor are you using? And if you're, you know, improving your farming methods or your manufacturing methods, or, you know, you're putting new machinery in that is far more efficient, you know, your productivity increases. And, you know, there's always the example, I guess, if I asked you, Dan, to go and dig up the Melbourne Cricket Ground and gave you a shovel, you know, probably come back this time next year and you might be just finishing it off. But if you jumped on one of Mr. Stokes's big
diggers,
earth moving thing, yeah, you'd probably have it done in half a day.
Super productive thanks to that business investment.
And that is a productivity improvement right there and then, because you're, you know, using better machinery, better technology, and, you know, you're doing it in a much quicker time with a lot less labour. But when you get an economy that is a service economy, it's actually quite difficult to measure productivity because, you know, let's say for teachers, for instance, are you going to improve productivity by doubling the size of a class? Well, no, that doesn't make the education system better, does it? But it, you know, so there's, when it comes to service economies, and Australia is predominantly a service economy, so trying to measure productivity is really difficult. But look, the one thing everybody agrees upon is that you need investment, and you need investment in machinery, in computing, in ideas. You need all kind, you need investment to, and management to basically to improve what you're doing. And what we've been doing for 30 years, as our productivity has declined, is been pumping money not into productive investment, but into houses.
Which would be inert objects that we live in.
Yeah. Partly because of what happened in the 1980s. Our banks were really lending huge amounts of money to the entrepreneurs of the day. A lot of them were a bit on the shifty side, you'd have to say, the Christopher Scases and Alan Bonds of the world. But they were, you know, they were getting huge amounts of money and a lot of support from the banking industry.
Well, let's go back to that period, because I was just out of primary school. I think, Ian, you were just also just out of a primary school in 1987.
No, I was actually covering all this stuff.
So that's where the money was going then. It was to get these companies to go global.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they were lending for.
John Elliott was buying up breweries across the world. I mean, everybody was going crazy. They were borrowing money here, left, right, and centre. And it was a similar kind of Ponzi scheme in a way, because they were all using debt to basically take over companies. And because you'd bid up the price of that company that you were taking over, other companies that were in the same kind of industry, the value of those rose as well. The share prices all rose. It was an incredible boom that we saw that was really being fueled by debt. Now, of course, it all came to grief in 1987 when the stock market crashed. And, you know, you had a couple two of our big four banks were on their knees, right? Westpac was in dire straits. It was, you know, essentially looked like it was going to need to be bailed out. And ANZ wasn't too far off as well. And so the net result of all of that, I mean, we got through that. The, you know, the treasurer at the time was basically pulling some strings. Nobody went under. But we had a lot of people going broke as well. The banks were really pulling in their loans to people who, you know, ordinary small business people. But the net result of all of that was the banks, when the dust all settled, they looked around and went, how are we going to recover from this? You know, there's no point trying to put money into you know, flashy companies, because they go broke and then we blow up billions of dollars in one loan. And they saw, oh, real estate. Yeah. I mean, everybody needs to have a roof over their head, don't they? And what happens when things turn ugly? Well, you'll find that the people with a roof over their head do not want to give it up under any circumstances whatsoever. They will do anything to avoid default. So it was a much safer form of business for the banks. And it became incredibly lucrative, because they discovered that, just like in the 80s with the corporations, the more money you'd lend out, the higher the prices went. The higher the prices went, the more people had to borrow. The more people borrowed, the higher your profits went. And it just went on and on and on. And then, of course, we got to the turn of the century and we had the capital gains tax discount imposed, which just turbocharged the whole episode.
So a seemingly kind of virtuous circle of ever-rising prices, government intervention to change and essentially financialize the property market, make that the vehicle, in some ways unintended. I mean, we've talked about this before. Some of the intention of the capital gains discount was to pump more money into the stock market. We had the recently declassified cabinet papers from the Howard years, where they basically said, the money seems to be going to investment speculation in real estate, one to watch. And then after that, absolutely took off. That left us, you know, in a really strange position in the world, where we have astonishingly high debt, astonishingly high household debt. What has that meant now that we're at this level? And there's been some unwinding. You've seen this government attempt to change those settings, attempt to change and divert investor money into more productive assets. What has it meant for Australia that we've had these settings, we've had these decades of pumping money into property, and we're in the position that we're in?
Well, what it means is that Australia is really super sensitive to interest rates now. And because most of our home loans are variable rate loans, and even the fixed rate loans are only for fairly short periods of time, it means every time that the Reserve Bank actually makes a move on interest rates, it either fires up the property market or it takes so much money out of household budgets that people are impacted immediately and they stop spending. So the effect of interest rate movements in Australia is magnified compared to most other places in the world. Now, look, if you just look at the bare numbers, I mean, Australians owe about $2.5 trillion in debt to their banks that's secured by mortgages. And the total value of our housing stock is $12.8 trillion. I mean, it's an extraordinary amount of money. Now, and you compare this to say, America. So in America, the value of the housing stock there is about double the size of the economy. In Australia, the value of our housing stock is four times the size of our economy. So that gives you a pretty good benchmark on where we've gone in terms of investment. All our investment efforts have been directed, not all, but the vast majority has been directed towards housing, and not just people putting a roof over their heads, but people competing with people who want to put a roof over their head, people buying, you know, huge numbers of properties and, you know, pushing, you know, new home buyers or first home buyers out of the market.
That gives banks less money to fund for business investment, less appetite as well. That's what we need to kind of push the economy along. What would it take for that dial to be shifted? I think we've seen some of that in the federal budget with an attempt to change the settings that are preferenced property. What would it take to move that dial so that it is more advantageous for banks and for people who want to invest, people who want to make money, to look instead to shares or investing in businesses?
Well, look, I think the moves they've made are probably going to do that. There's a bit of criticism around the government for not going hard enough from the Greens. And of course, the opposition is saying it shouldn't have been done at all. And of course, it did break a promise. Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister, said there would be no changes to negative gearing and no changes to the capital gains tax discount. So the government has to live with that, having said that, and then going ahead to do it. I think this will have the desired impact. It will slow down the rate of growth in the housing market. Bear in mind, there are not enough houses, not enough dwellings to basically have a roof over the head of our population. So, you know, the demand is outstripping supply at the moment. So we are going to have further increases in property prices, but it's just not going to be, you know, turboed up to the extent that it was. But having said that, you'd have to think that we're pretty much at the limit when it comes to affordability. I mean, affordability now is just—it's just gone too far. It's non-existent in terms of, particularly for first home buyers. And you know, the factors that led to that, you know, reaching that peak were we had pretty much 30 years of declining interest rates. We had all this money being pumped in by the banks. And you put those two factors together, and that just enabled people to borrow more and more and more to be able to buy a house. Now, we're at a point where interest rates went to zero. They're now up to, you know, what, 3-4% in around that range. Historically, you'd have to say the average would be possibly a little higher than that over the next 30 years or so. So we're not going to see declining interest rates as we saw for the past 30 years. So that means the affordability question or the affordability factor when it comes to interest rates is we're heading in the other direction. And so prices, that's where prices come into play. So prices either have to come down or at least not rise as fast as incomes.
I had a top economist recently describe our housing system as Edwardian, and they didn't mean it as a compliment. They meant that it was becoming essentially almost generational, that if you were unable to leverage existing wealth from property via your family, it would become more difficult. We've seen that in the course of the rise of the Bank of Mum and Dad, Ed, to become one of the biggest lenders in Australia.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a pretty poor state of affairs when you think about it. I mean, we like to think of ourselves as an egalitarian society and everybody gets a fair go, but we're now at a point where if you aren't born into a family that owns property, then you're going to be financially not as well off permanently for the rest of your life, and you'll probably never buy a property either. So, you know, unless you're incredibly bright and you land some job that earns you a lot of money, but you need to be, you know, as a fairly young person, you need to be earning huge amounts of money to be able to just save for a deposit. I mean, it's just not really as – it was never easy, but it's far more difficult to do now than it was ever has been in the past, really.
Ian, fuel, property, I think we'll cut short from the usual 2 hours we had set aside for this. It's been wonderful to chat. That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to send in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. That's ABC Business Daily, all one word, @abc.net.au. Catch you later.
See you, Dan.